Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, this is February 22nd, 2011. Members, today we have overviews coming first, a review of the governor's budget recommendations for our jurisdiction. And Mr. Turner will be giving us a blow-by-blow on that. And then later we'll be looking over the Minnesota probation system overview. And I may want to remind you that Minnesota is a low incarceration state, so issues of probation and parole are more of a mainstay in how we react to regarding criminal sanction. And so it's very important for us to see how this system works in light of a heavier concentration for incarceration. But right now we're going to start with Mr. Turner. Mr. Turner, you've reviewed the governor's budget recommendations, I would imagine. And are you ready for presentation?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, you have three documents in front of you. First, we have the budget book that was assembled and tabbed by the committee page Andrew Matthews. Then you also should have a spreadsheet that was put together by me, which distills the budget book. And then you should have a short memo on the fire safety account in the special revenue fund, which we'll get to later. We'll start with the budget book. The budget book contains the information, the budgetary information, for all the agencies under the committee's jurisdiction. Each agency will submit to MMB, and then MMB will edit and compile the agency profile, the fiscal information with for the agency, which would include a general fund base calculation for the current biennium, any other funds that are applicable to that agency. Then it will it'll include the governor's change items, if any, and then when applicable, once again, any federal fund summaries, state or federal grants, and agency revenue. From the budget book, I distill the numbers in the budget book into the spreadsheet. The spreadsheet lists all direct appropriations. These are the numbers that will end up in the bill, the appropriations bill that we will eventually pass. To explain the spreadsheet, I've got on the columns, you've got first the agency and the program, then the fund, whether general fund, special revenue fund, trunk highway fund, or other. Then the previous biennium, for comparative purposes, fiscal year 10 and 11. Then the governor's recommendation, fiscal year 12 and 13, and the total. You have the base number, any change item requests, and then the total for each agency. I also have a fiscal year 11 column because we have three fiscal year 11 appropriations recommended by the governor. Then we have two, fiscal year 14 and 15 tails, and then this spreadsheet will grow throughout the session. The next column will be Senate recommendation for 12 and 13, and then 14, 15 tails. Then it will be the House recommendation and the comparison, and finally the conference committee recommendation, which will be the final bill. So right now, I guess we can go through the spreadsheet. A few preliminary comments. If we just want to start as an example on line three, Supreme Court operations. The Supreme Court has two separate entities, Supreme Court operations, which is the court itself and the state court administrator's office, and then it has civil legal services. So just as an exercise, if you look on line three, we've got Supreme Court operations. It's a general fund account. We've got the fiscal year 10 and 11 amount. It's at $61.759 million. Then we have the governor's rec. Now, that the 12 and 13, that would be the base calculation. And a base calculation is a projection from the second year of the last biennium. In this case, it would be 2011, minus any one-time appropriations and plus or minus any transfers or law or forecast changes. Our budget is a relatively simple budget. It only has one forecasted item, the number of prisoners in the state prison system. So it's not driven by forecast changes like K-12 or human services. So Supreme Court operations would have a base of $60,728,000. On line five, we have the change item. The governor recommended $94,012 and $395,013 for a total of $489,000 be added to the base of the Supreme Court for a total for the biennium of $61,217,000. I'm not going to go through this through the entire spreadsheet, but that is the way you would read the spreadsheet. And then as you see over in tails, the last year of the previous biennium, 395, projects into fiscal year 14 and 15. That's how the spreadsheet's put together. The first page is of the spreadsheet concerns the courts. And the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, District Courts, and then the Guardian Ad Litem Board, which used to be part of the District Courts until last year when the legislature created its own separate board and transferred their budget from the District Court budget to the new board. The recommendation, technically this is a court request from the legislature, which the governor concurred with. The court, if you remember, the court came in and they requested $6 million in what they called a hold harmless budget. It would be, the money would cover the health insurance and pension increases that are projected. And there was no money for increased salaries or any other activity. The health insurance projections from MMB are 7.7% starting January 1, 2012, and 16.2% in January 1, 2013. And so, and the pension increases were minimal. So those numbers, those change items for the courts on page 1, lines 5 for the Supreme Court, 20 for Court of Appeals, 26 for trial courts or district courts, and 34 for guardian ad litem board. Those are almost all health care increases with a little bit of a para contribution thrown in. There's no, as the courts pointed out, there's no additional compensation of any kind in this request. And that was the court request, and the governor concurred with it. And if we move on, then we'll get to the executive agencies. On page 2, we have the tax court, the base of $1,580,000. We have a 2011 deficiency request of $38,000, and then $35,000 increases each year for a total of it'd be $108,000, including fiscal year 11. It's $35,000. Increase each year pretty much just reinstates the cuts that we made in 2009 and 2010. And then the 3,000 deficiency in fiscal year 11, they explain it as having. I'll let them explain that one too, actually. I don't know why fiscal year. I don't know why they can't budget that $3,000 out, seeing as how we're still in fiscal year 11. So I'll let them explain it. If we move on, Uniform Laws Commission is straight base budget request of $98,000. Board of Judicial Standards a base of $884,000. Once again, we have a 2011 deficiency of $290,000. That has to do with five ongoing judicial investigations, and then the increase of $14,000 a year. Which once again pretty much would reinstate the 2009-2010 cuts to the board. Moving on to the Public Defense Board, line 59, the governor recommends a 5% funding increase. That would come out to $6,472,000. Once again, if you look back in 2009, the Public Defense Board was cut by $4 million. 2010 was cut by $1.9 million for a total of $5.9 million. So this is, in some respects, like the Board on Judicial Standards and the Tax Court, reinstating the cuts from the 2009 legislature and the 2010 legislature. Moving on to the Department of Public Safety, we have here we encounter our first non-general fund appropriations. Real quickly, the special revenue appropriation there on line 64 of $1,208,000 is from the fire safety account, and it's for hazardous material team reimbursements. The $138,000 from the environmental fund is a hazardous chemical community right to know position that's funded. It's been funded there for 20 years. And then we have the general fund appropriation for Homeland Security Emergency Management of $3,704,000. The only change in the governor's recommendation, or the only decision item, is the fiscal year 2011 deficiency payment for the state disaster match of $2,043,000. We continue in the next page. We're still in the Department of Public Safety. This would be page three for those who just came in. On the BCA, once again, we have a couple direct appropriations that are non-general fund. The state government special revenue fund on page, or on line 75 with the BCA, that funds a vulnerable adults report that's been mandated for the last 20 years. And then the trunk highway fund appropriation on line 76, that's trunk highway fund money that pays for part of the state patrol DWI lab costs. And as the state patrol is funded by the trunk highway fund, it was determined I think it was 4 years ago that trunk highway fund should fund some of the lab costs for state highway patrol DUI arrests. Then if we move on to the fire marshal, that is the reason I handed out this short memo on the fire safety account. It's the governor has two initiatives here under the fire marshal, and neither of them have anything to do with the fire marshal, but they have to do with the fire safety account. And the fire safety account was established in 2006. It's comprised of a 0.65% surcharge on premiums for homeowners insurance policies and commercial fire policies. And it was meant to take the fire marshal off of the general fund, move it from a general fund to a special revenue fund footing, and then to create firefighter training funds in as well. And what has happened is, certainly not intentionally, but the surcharge is bringing in a lot more money than anybody ever thought. And so this memo shows, at the end of fiscal year 2011, and the account balance was $113,000. The estimated revenue for this biennium is $26.4 million. Now, under current law, as I show in the memo, we have a general fund transfer of $4.7 million. We have the fire marshal's base funding of $8.6 million. Then we have the transfer for hazardous material team reimbursement of $1.2 million. Then we have fire service training, similar to what the Post Board does, at $2,940,000. And that leaves an account surplus of $9,055,000. Now, in the past 2 years, we have captured that and transferred it to the general fund, but only on a one-time basis, leaving it to the next legislature to decide what to do. The governor's request here, if you would just continue on my memo, I guess, you've got the surplus of $9,055,000. The governor requests transferring $5,266,000 of that to the general fund, and that would essentially be a savings. And then he suggests switching from general fund funding to special revenue fund funding from this account, $2,734,000 to fund the health insurance reimbursement for police and firefighters who have been disabled in the line of duty. That's a program that was established back in the 90s. The claims have exceeded the appropriation for about 10 years, so we had to cap it at $1,367,000 per year, and now the claims are paid on a prorated basis. So those are the governor's two fire safety account related requests.
Mr. Turner? One question. This has, according to your memo, that this fire safety account was based on surcharges on premiums for homeowner insurance policies with the downward tracking of real estate sales. Has anyone looked at it from that perspective, that we have less transactions? And with less transactions, we would have less money going into this pool. Do you know if the governor has considered that in his recommendations of taking this money from that pool?
Mr. Chairman, what you say makes a lot of sense. I don't know if they've revised their projections, although I do know that the current numbers were gathered in November. You know, we can certainly track and make sure that the money's coming in as projected.
Yeah. Something to remind ourselves of later. Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members, moving on to gambling and alcohol enforcement within the Department of Public Safety. We have a special revenue appropriation of $1.3 million. That's a special revenue fund that consists of money from Indian compacts, gambling forfeitures, and money that the agency gets on performing background checks.
Mr. Chair.
The general fund.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Pardon me. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. To your point with regards to the fire safety account, did you not say that was growing a lot bigger than it was in the past, or exceeded the revenues?
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, when it was created in 2006, they didn't think it was going to bring in $26 million a year. It did.
Do you remember what their projections were, Mr. Chair?
I think they were approximately half that.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and you made the point of, with regards to losing sales and with the market?
Right. Senator Ingebrigtsen, this is a surcharge on premiums every time there's a homeowner insurance policy that's created. Usually that's done at the time of a closing on a real estate transaction. And so if you go back to 2006 when this was first started, that was a fairly healthy, robust real estate market compared to what it is now. So now we have less sales, which trigger less surcharges. If we raid the pool, how soon will we get the money back into the pool to sustain it? That's the only question I'm asking. And it should be something that we should consider while we're considering this recommendation from the governor's office.
To understand, though, these are ongoing monthly premiums that are being paid year-round by every household. Correct. So those that didn't buy in the market, they were continuing to pay. Not just new households is what I'm saying.
Senator Britson, you are correct. It's partially at closing and it's partially at monthly. That goes on the monthly insurance for mortgage insurance, isn't it?
So it'd be fair, excuse me, Mr. Chair, it'd be fair to say that if we had a reduction in...
It is not mortgage insurance. It's homeowner insurance.
Homeowners. So if we have a reduction in homeowners in Minnesota, then we'd see a decrease, but we've seen an increase.
All right. I was under the impression it may have been title insurance. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, it's a 0.65% surcharge. So that means it's on the total amount. Of the premium, and premiums have gone up quite a bit in the last few years on homeowners. I think Minnesota has one of the highest loss figures in the country in terms of like storm damage, and I don't even know if we're second to hurricane states. I mean, you probably all can look out your window and see all the roofs that have been replaced and. You know, more than once in the last 10 years in my neighborhood, and siding and that sort of thing. So I'm assuming that's what happened, is that 0.65, and I don't know if it's something, well, I'm not even going to suggest anything else. I think that's what, it's a function of that.
The only thing we know is it's gaining a lot more money in the pool than ever was imagined.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, We're on gambling and alcohol enforcement. There's this, the governor made, he made no request for additional funds. It's a straight baseline funding for gambling and alcohol. Then we moved to Office of Justice Programs. Base budget of $68 million, mainly transfers and grants. The governor does have one change item there titled Network for Better Futures. It's a reentry program that's been funded by the legislature before. It's out of North Minneapolis. This committee gave them $1.6 million in 2007. The state has added an additional $2.5 million through grants from DEED and the Housing Finance Agency for a total of $4.1 million. They're requesting $2.9 million for the next biennium, and the governor agreed and included it in his budget.
Mr. Turner, could you pull your microphone a little closer? There seems to be a lot of noise in this building, and especially upstairs. And
sure, Mr. Turner.
I'm having trouble hearing.
Okay. Moving on, the last Department of Public Safety division is Emergency Communication Networks. It's a state government special revenue fund, the 911 account. This is the 80 cents per telephone line per month that you pay. What we have, the governor is recommending $6.8 million be appropriated from the 911 account to the Department of Public Safety for operation and maintenance on the ARMR emergency public radio system. And that's it for public safety. Then we move on to the post board, where the governor has two change requests. First of all, the post board is funded by the special revenue fund. It is authorized to receive 39% of the first $25 of the $75 criminal traffic surcharge. That's what they're authorized to receive, up to 39%, but they only get what we appropriate to them. And recently, it's been stagnant or cut, and they're presently receiving approximately 29% of the first $25 of the surcharge. The governor has requested two cuts to the post board. The first is a 5% operations reduction, which would translate into one person. I believe they have 12 people administering the post board right now, so they'd be down to 11. Then a 5% training reimbursement reduction, which translates into approximately $15 cut per officer per year. Presently, they're funding officers training reimbursements for officers at $358,000 a year. This would cut it. This recommendation would cut it to $343,000. Private Detective Board and the Human Rights, the governor made no change requests. Straight base budget request. We move on to the Department of Corrections, which is one half of our budget. Under institutions, one thing I'd like to point out is for fiscal year 10 and 11, there's a federal line there. It says $30 million. That is directly related to the first change request on line 155, maintaining funding for core prison operations at $26.9 million. What happened was in 2009, for the 10 and 11 biennium, the legislature used $38 million in federal ERA funds and only carried over $11 million in TAILs, and that created a $26.9 thousand dollar problem in the institution's operating budget, and for perspective, that's about 1 year of operating one of our medium sized prisons. On the next line, we have maintaining favorable chemical dependency treatment beds at 150. The governor requesting $1,350,000, $450,000 the first year, $900,000 the second. This would be to replace a federal CD grant that is expiring December 31st of this year. That funds 90 CD beds. if this money isn't appropriated, we'll go from 180 CD beds at Faribault back down to 90. The next line, 157, and the institution's reduction, 5 FTEs is the way I've described it. It's a reduction in 5 positions, 5 administrative positions within the institution's division. Move down to community services. The community services equivalent of the generic reduction in institutions, they calculated at 4 FTEs at 632,000. That would apparently be 4 administrative positions within community services, which are the people that we're going to be listening to in about 5 minutes here. Then we go on to the next three lines, is supervision reductions directly relevant to the presentation following line. We have a CCA subsidy reduction of 2.5%, a CPO, which is County Probation Officer reimbursement reduction of 2.5%, and a DOC field services reduction of 2.5%. Those are the three probation delivery systems in the state of Minnesota. CCA, of course, is the largest. I think 75%, approximately 3/4 of felons are supervised by under the CCA Act. That's why they've got the larger percentage cut, and then followed by CPO and then DOC field services. And then finally, on line 171, the governor recommends that the Dodge-Fillmore County Enhanced Sex Offender Program that was established back in the 90s be eliminated. There's no other CCA agency in the state that's getting money comparable to this. And in tough times, I guess the governor decided that he doesn't think Dodge Fillmore Homestead should continue to receive that grant. Finally, on operation support, line 180, a reduction of $670,000. Again, that's a generic 5 FTEs to be determined by the commissioner within the administration of the department. And then finally, our last agency is the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and the governor makes no change requests. It's a straight-based budget request for sentencing guidelines. And then we have totals on the spreadsheet, and for your information, then we have revenue adjustments to the general fund. It's more important to me than it is to you, but we see the fire safety account transfer to the general fund where we have to track that, and then the post board adjustment to the general fund. Any changes you make in the post board, up or down, affects the bottom line. And that, Mr. Chairman, is the spreadsheet and the governor's budget request.
Any questions? Mr. Chair. Senator Letts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Turner, maybe I'm missing something here. Maybe you can help me out. On line 189, shows the total corrections budget. Fiscal year 10-11 is $895 million, and for 12-13 is $916 million. Am I reading that right? It's an increase?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, for the 10 and 11, I'm sorry. Okay, you're comparing the 895 to the 916, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, that would be, there were a number of, there was a forecast adjustment there, and then a number of programs that were funded in 2009, and that was agency wide. That was the increase from institutions, community services, and operations support. If you look though, institutions is the biggest part of the budget, and is the one that everybody consider or when they think of corrections, they think of the prison system. If you look at fiscal year 10 and 11, all funds under institutions, it's $668 million. For 12 and 13, the request is $657 million. a drop-off of 11 million. That's because of the federal funding. The one-time federal funding is gone, and then there are forecast changes as the prison population goes up.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Lett.
But I see on line 160, looks like the institution funds out of the general fund anyway jumped. So jumps from 629 to 656.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Lett, that's when I presented this, I said that the important line here is line 152 and 161, the federal money. It really messes things up. The federal money came in and was part of the operating budget for fiscal years 10 and 11. So the true cost for running the prison system for 10 and 11 was the $629 million plus $38 million, which comes to 660 whatever. And now if you look over under 12 and 13, we have a $656 million request. So the true comparison would be combining 629 and 38 million, which is the prison operating budget, to the 656. And in that case, the budget actually went down.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Engelbritton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there just a general overview of how many FTEs the governor wants to cut out of this whole budget without counting them up? Do you happen to know?
Mr. Turner?
Actually, we can do a quick run right now. There would be the court budget would be a hold harmless budget, so they say, so there wouldn't be any FTEs there. Within Department of Corrections, they say 14. One in the post board, that's 15. I think that would be about it, because the public defense board gets their $6 million increase, they shouldn't be laying off anybody, I wouldn't think.
Mr. Turner, how many positions would be found in the Douglas Fillmore Enhanced Sex Offender Programming?
I'm sorry, Mr.
If we're eliminating,
I forgot about community services. Yeah. Yes, there would be some positions lost in community services, both state and county positions. And then, of course, it looks to me $138,000 a year, that's probably one and a half positions, like one field agent, some administrative support, and some gasoline is pretty much what that would be. And so there would be one missed there as well. So I don't know. Maybe the Department of Corrections can give you a better idea of what this roughly $4 million decrease in field services, what kind of FTE loss that represents.
Mr. Turner, do you know if any of these jobs lost could be absorbed through attrition, or is this a hard cut?
Mr. Chairman, members, traditionally that's what the agencies try and do is lose the jobs through attrition.
Sure.
And of course, if you fire people, you have fire people without cause. You've got a tenant cost to the state. So
right. Okay. All right. The other question that I had, Mr. Turner, is I see that the health and in the health insurance and para increases, they seem to be limited to the courts and the guardian ad litem board. Do you know how that money is, where it comes from? I know it says general fund, but is this coming out of other agencies, or where does it originate?
Mr. Chairman, members, that projected increase applies to all state agencies. The governor listed here as a change item because when the courts discussed their budget with the governor and the legislature, they said that they need, this is what they need most as an attempt to not lose positions. So it's called here a change item. It doesn't have to be for health insurance. We could just give them the department or the Board of Public Defense is getting $6 million that will most likely go to health insurance because that has to be paid. All other state agencies are, if it's not a change item under their line, are going to have to absorb these costs. These costs are apply to every state employee.
So, Mr. Turner, if it's in every agency, do we have the same line item in, let's say, the Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chairman, no. No, they're just going to have to absorb that cost.
I see. Any other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Turner, with regards to the E911 fund, can you explain that to the group, how that revenue comes in, and what's the remaining balance of that? Do you have a balance on that, or is that someplace else we have to look?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, what was your reference again?
The emergency 911 armor system. There's going to be expenditures going out there, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if Mr. Turner has an idea as to what the balance is there.
Mr. Turner.
And how that comes about.
Mr. Chairman, members, the 911 account consists of the per-line telephone tax. It's 80 cents per month per line. And that flows into the 911 account, which then pays for it pays for public safety answering points. It pays for the state, the backbone for the state emergency radio system. And then it pays the debt service on the revenue bonds that that the state sells to create, expand, and enhance the public radio system. I think those are the three main uses of the money. What the account balance is, I can't tell you right here, but I can certainly get it for you. I was told by the Department of Finance that that this money is the money for operations and maintenance that's part of the change request is in the account, and it won't take it, they won't have to up the monthly fee to access this money. And as the operations maintenance costs expand, as the radio system expand statewide.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the debt relief you're talking about, that was a couple years ago when we finished the backbone of the armor system. Is that what you're talking about? Did we borrow money there, or did we have a one-time appropriation for that?
Mr.
Not understanding the ongoing debt.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we have sold and continue to sell revenue bonds that are backed by the 911 fee. What their schedule is, I can't really say. I'd defer to the finance department if anyone was here for that. I can find out.
And to be clear, that's on all cell phones as well, right? That
yes.
Fee? Yes.
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
He took my question.
He does that a lot.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Harrington.
Yeah, my question is in regard to the fire marshal account, line 86 again. And I'm wondering, does that account also pay for the regional hazmat and specialty fire reduction programs?
Mr. Turner.
Sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Harrington. Part of that account goes towards I don't know if it's the I believe it's the hazmat team reimbursements. We did that 2 years ago when once again this account was here and there was surplus money and we wanted some general fund savings, and I believe it was a House initiative that the Senate concurred with where they decided to make some hazmat reimbursements with this money through Homeland Security and Emergency Management. It's $604,000 each year goes towards hazmat reimbursement.
And is that money going to be reduced as part of this reduction, or is that money going to be transferred from someplace else?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harrington, that's part of the base budget that is projected off into the future, $604,000 a year.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Mr. Turner, thank you for the overview. Appreciate it. Next on our agenda is the Minnesota Probation System overview. Commissioner Roy. This is our new Commissioner of Department of Corrections, Mr. Tom Roy. And Commissioner, have you ever been before a Senate Judiciary Committee before?
I believe I have a couple times.
Okay, the hazing can't happen then.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Commissioner Roy and I have had a number of very good telephone calls over recent weeks, and by what I can tell, he seems to be an excellent appointment to the Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Mary.
And maybe what you could do, Commissioner, is give a little background of where you come from and a little of your experience before you delve into your presentation.
Mr. Chair and Senators, it is indeed a pleasure to be here this afternoon. I actually come from a very heavily oriented probation background. For the past 36 years, my life has been engaged in probation activities, first as a very young probation officer. At age 22, I started. And all of my career has been served in northeastern Minnesota in the Arrowhead region. I progressed through the ranks, and I'm very proud to say that I did do that. I became a supervisor in Carlton County, then became an officer in St. Louis County in Duluth, a chief probation officer in Arrowhead Regional Corrections, and just 3 weeks ago left my job as executive director of Arrowhead Regional Corrections. I am especially pleased to be talking about probation this afternoon. And hopefully we can have a good conversation, and hopefully I can add to your abilities to make good policy when it comes to correctional work. I am very fortunate to take a job in a department that I think is very healthy at this point in time, and some of my conversation this afternoon with you will be to talk about the relative health of the Department of Corrections. I am not the only presenter this afternoon. Behind me are some very qualified folks who will make introductions themselves, but I am confident that their input will be valuable for you as well. Senator Limmer, Mr. Chair, I am ready to proceed with this presentation if you
Please
think that's
ahead.
An adequate introduction.
Well, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much. I need to preface my presentation with a couple comments. And I talked about the relative health of corrections in Minnesota. And I think that health is due to some forward-thinking people about 35 years ago. And those were the people that conceived of the notion of community corrections and also the people that implemented sentencing guidelines within Minnesota. The implementation of both of those very important pieces of legislation have led to a system that I think is the model for the country. The sentencing guidelines provides a system of rational sentencing, very predictable sentencing. And I know you folks have had an overview of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission already, but it's a system that lends itself to predictability, assurance of uniform sentencing, and our ability to predict prison populations. It also assures the citizens of Minnesota that only the most dangerous offenders actually go to prison. The implementation of the Community Corrections Act established a mechanism where counties could join together and take care of their own citizens. And I think that really is the premise for community corrections generally, that you just don't send your offenders away, expect them to come back better citizens. Community corrections is really founded on the notion that each community is responsible for our own offenders. And that philosophy has driven much of the development of corrections in Minnesota. The Department of Corrections has basic oversight of not only the Community Corrections Act, but also the correctional services delivered at the county level as well. And the folks behind me will be talking specifically about those two disciplines. The Department of Corrections, and you can see on the first slide here that the Department of Corrections serves counties in the probation world as well as the prison world. And the Department of Corrections provides adult, felony, misdemeanor, and juvenile supervision in 28 counties. In 55 counties, we have an arrangement to provide adult felony supervision. And in 75 counties, we provide intensive supervised release. And some of you folks probably know that more commonly called parole. And 82 counties get our challenge incarceration program services, which releases offenders out of prison into a very disciplined regime into the communities. The Community Corrections Act counties that I referred to, and folks behind me will be talking more about this, but 32 counties are formed under the Community Corrections Act, 17 total jurisdictions, and those Community Corrections Act counties do probation and parole work, but a good number of those counties also have corrections facilities, and that's a very important feature of this whole Community Corrections Act because those facilities also save the Department of Corrections significant prison beds. And the county probation officers are formed under a statute as well, and that system allows for counties to hire their own probation officers in concert with judges, and those counties primarily serve juvenile and misdemeanor offenders. And you will hear more about those in a moment. Prison population, and you may be asking why a prison population slide shows up in a probation presentation, but this is very important information. Minnesota's prison growth is pretty consistent with that around the country. However, I'm going to draw your attention immediately to the bottom of this slide, which talks about Minnesota having the second lowest rate of prison incarceration in the country. And primarily, that is due to the fact that we have a very robust probation system, even though we have a relatively normal crime rate and nothing spectacular in terms of population growth. But clearly, again, I'll draw your attention to the fact that we have a very low prison incarceration rate. And in a few moments, you'll see those statistics very clearly. Again, supervised release is what we traditionally call parole. At any given time, there are about 5,500 offenders out on parole, and the balance being on probation, and this includes all systems on probation, 132,000. So you can see that Minnesota relies very heavily on the probation system compared to prison populations. We have a breakdown here of juvenile, female, felony, gross misdemeanor, misdemeanor. And you may look at these misdemeanor offenses and be startled by the number of misdemeanors on probation. For a lot of communities, misdemeanor offenders, and I'll look at my law enforcement committee members here, misdemeanor offenders can significantly impact community safety and the health of a community. Many smaller communities in greater Minnesota, the vast majority of their offenders are, in fact, misdemeanor offenders. And included in those, of course, are DWI offenders, domestic abuse, misdemeanor assault, offenders that can really impact the health of a community. Juvenile offenders, of course, are very important to us, and our statistics show that as kids become involved in crime at an early age, the likelihood of them getting involved in adult future criminal behavior is pretty significant. Again, a representation of the types of offenders that we deal with. And here is one of those recidivism statistics that I hope I get some questions on. And the interpretation of this bar chart is that for the 11,000 probationers that had their case closed in 2006, 96% were free of felony behavior in the first 6 months. 93% were free of felony behavior within the first year, 88% in 2 years, and 85% in 3 years. Typically, recidivism results are reported at the 3-year mark. So what this says is that of the felon probationers that were released from probation in 2006, 15% got new felony convictions. I would be totally remiss this afternoon if I led you to believe that that was the only recidivism statistic that is meaningful. Certainly those felony offenders became involved in misdemeanor behavior, and certainly any number of those offenders became involved in probation violation activities. Some of those offender groups, and I'll be glad in future meetings to talk about the nuances of recidivism, but clearly I would not want you to say that only 15% of offenders, felony offenders, ever violate their probation. That is just not the case. Some felony offender groups recidivate at 30 or 40% when you include the other types of offenses. But I could spend an afternoon going over recidivism statistics. I just want to lay that out to you, to be perfectly frank with you. But I won't dismiss the importance of this. Certainly felons committing new felonies is something we should be concerned about. Our Department of Corrections Field Services Unit, as I have said, we provide supervision in the counties and parole supervision in any number of locations around the state. We also are engaged in the management of the Interstate Compact, and that's the transfer of offenders from one state to another. We have many hundreds of offenders that leave the state, and we have many hundreds of offenders that come into the state. And the management of those offenders is very important to us, particularly when it comes to high-risk offenders. And I know some of you are familiar with sex offender supervision and the assessment of risk when it comes to sex offenders. And lots of the activity around the Interstate Compact is assessing the risk of those offenders that come into our state. One of the big activities and one of the activities that we're very proud of, not only in the Department of Corrections but in our community corrections agencies, is the fact that we put lots of offenders to work in the communities. I know you're familiar with the Sentence to Service program. Lots of you like that program. And early in my career, I was a supervisor of a juvenile crew. And if I can just digress for a moment and tell you of a story that really hit home for me when I considered the value of work crews. I had a 14-year-old boy on a Saturday morning cleaning up a community center. I had a crew of about 12 or so, and we had brooms and mops and rakes and rags and buckets, and we were going to clean this community center because the community just didn't have janitorial services. I dispersed the rakes and I dispersed the mops, and I told one individual, I'll never forget this kid, I put the mop in his hand and he had a bucket next to him, and I said, David, just mop this hallway. He looked at me, he looked at the bucket, he looked at the mop, and he had absolutely no clue what to do with a mop. And I stood there and looked at him, and at first I thought it was his attitude. And then I realized that he had never had a mop in his hand in his life. He dipped the mop in the bucket, and he started dabbing the mop up and down. He had no notion that you should move the mop side to side. And it struck me at that point in time, especially with young offenders, how little experience they have with real work. And I am going to be a fierce advocate for the promotion of work. I think offenders, especially young offenders, really value and really it is a value to them for their future success. We do work release out of the prisons, getting offenders jobs. getting them oriented to making an honest career is very important, and that affects recidivism significantly. We are also responsible for our supervision in those 55 counties. Again, juvenile and misdemeanor offenders. This slide basically shows the administration of our services in greater Minnesota. Again, the breakdown of some of our activities related to different offenses. Specifically to Department of Corrections, and I'll bring you to the second bullet immediately, we have a significant number of probation officers. You can quickly calculate the ratio of supervisors and clerical staff and the number of adult and juvenile offenders. Again, we only do part of the supervision, and the vast majority of supervision in the community is done by Community Corrections Act counties. Just as our partners in the other service delivery systems, we attempt to do the good science behind criminal justice. We know that if we focus our work on high-risk offenders, our results are a lot better. And we're going to focus our attention on high-risk offenders. The research shows us, actually, that if we do too much time on low-risk offenders, we can actually make them worse. And I know that's counterintuitive. We would like to think that we can benefit everybody in this world, but sometimes just getting arrested is enough for a lot of low-risk offenders. So we really need, especially with limited resources, to really focus our attention on those offenders that cause harm in our communities. Workload is a big concern to us always, and using risk tools to help us in that effort is very important, especially with declining resources. That is a very abbreviated overview of the Department of Corrections involvement in field services. The people behind me will add to this discussion. But, Mr. Chair, I'm certainly open to take questions at this point in time, or we can wait till the end when the total picture is presented by those folks behind me.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions? Yes, Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. It's a pleasure to meet you. And I was intrigued a little bit by the second point on that last slide. Resources are used more effectively when they're focused on higher risk. Could you give it seems almost counterintuitive to me, so I wondered if you could kind of give me an example. And I'm sure if I didn't have other things on my mind, I'd probably be able to figure this out by myself. But maybe you could just kind of describe what you mean by the effective use of resources toward a higher risk versus
Mr. Fisher. Senator, the science of risk assessment is pretty sophisticated at this point in time. Back when I started as a probation officer, we did a lot of gut-level risk assessment. We use tools now, and those tools measure what's called criminogenic factors. And there are a variety of tools for a variety of offenders, but it has now become a pretty good science, and it's actually tools that indicate to us actual points. And darned if those points don't really predict the risk of reoffending. There are certain offenders at the very high end of that risk that changing behavior is highly unlikely, and it really becomes a question of surveillance, deterrence, or incapacitation. But there's a high middle range of offenders who may be chemically dependent, who may have some mental illness that's showing in their lives, may have some housing issues, may have things that, if we stabilize them, deal with those particular issues, they may never reoffend again. At the very low end of that risk assessment, there are offenders who have pretty good stability factors in their lives. They have jobs. They have a family structure that's supportive. They have pretty healthy community contacts. And really, their criminal behavior just may be singular, really aberrant in the total picture of their life. And as I said before, just getting arrested might may be enough. So if we program those very low-risk people, some of that programming may actually put them in contact with higher-risk people. So by limiting that contact, by providing them with minimal support, we'll probably never see those people again. And the risk science actually proves that. I hope I've answered you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's really interesting, and I've been on the Judiciary Committee before, but we didn't really do the public safety discussion that often. So I'm fascinated by this. I wonder, does everybody low risk to highest risk, do they all get some kind of an assessment? Is that kind of just go with the territory?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Senator, that will vary from agency to agency, and just because of the workload, there might be some very low-risk first offenders that don't get a formal, full-blown risk assessment, but they probably will get a minimum screening tool, and that screening tool then will tell us if, in fact, we have to do the full-blown risk assessment. And it's a pretty significant workload to pull this risk assessment off, but most agencies now, it's built into their protocols.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome as well. On that same note, Senator Scheid was making maybe not directly to the same point, but talk also about the level 3 sex offenders that we now have are under civil commitment. Can you tell me how many we have now and how that program's working?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that would be called the more than $1 million question. There are over 600 civilly committed offenders. I happened to sit through the presentation in the Human Services. Mr. Benson gave a very comprehensive overview, and I'm not sure if this committee has heard that presentation yet, but it is certainly a complex issue, and I might just talk about the Department of Corrections involvement in that process. At the end of confinement, there is a group of professionals within our department who have long experience with treatment and risk assessment of sex offenders. Out of that assessment comes a recommendation for referral to the county attorneys for their review and for their decision to move forward with a civil commitment or not. So that decision to move forward with that process falls with the county attorney. If, in fact, it is found, then the placement is made at the facilities, the two facilities for civilly committed sex offenders. It's a very complex issue, and I hope that you folks have the opportunity to hear that presentation from Mr. Benson in that department. There is no doubt, and I'm predicting that much of my life in the next 2 or 3 months will be very engaged with the level 3 sex offender issue, not only for the civilly committed offenders, but also for those offenders who are released into the community that don't go through the civil service or civil commitment process. It is clearly the most important issue that we're facing today, I think.
Just
any other questions?
A follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So of the six, you have 600 now that are confined under civil commitment. How many level 3 sex offenders have been released into society in Minnesota? Do you have a record of how many we have?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it was reported that there have been no releases from the civilly committed offenders. It's my understanding that two are currently being processed for release, a structured release. And, of course, that is not under the Department of Corrections system. And I probably can't enlighten this committee on the exact structure of that release, nor the time frames involved.
One more little follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, you're doing damage to my schedule today.
Just real quickly, let's finish on a good note. The ICWC program has been a very successful program in the state. How many programs did we have when it was in its prime, and what are we down to now? Those are building programs.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I cannot answer that question. I know that that work activity has been very important to communities, and I wish my lexicon would provide that answer to me at this point in time, but I will certainly get that answer to you.
Thank you.
We'll be having the commissioner come back next Thursday. So you can make a longer list of questions. Senator Ingebrigtsen, Senator Harrington, you're in a hold. All right. We have two other witnesses or testifiers today. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
If we could have them approach the table, Carol Roberts and Steve Paquet. Commissioner, was it next week or this coming Thursday? This coming Thursday, the commissioner will be here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Lemur. Senators.
Ms. Roberts, welcome to the
Thank you
committee.
Very much. Senator and senators, I am the president of the Minnesota Community Corrections Act County Association. I'm also the director of corrections for Ramsey County. So we wanted to tell you a little bit about our organization, which is MACAC. It's an organization of corrections directors from the Community Correction Act jurisdictions.
Ms. Roberts, could I ask you to state your full name and the organization you're working with?
Yes.
For the record.
Yes.
Thank you.
Carol Roberts, Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. I'm the president of that organization.
Please proceed.
So MACAC is composed of directors of Community Corrections Act County departments throughout the state. Most directors, like myself, have come up through the ranks. Our mission is to develop correctional policy, to have a platform for ideas and advancement of the field, the professional advancement of the field, and a forum for the exchange of resources and information between members. We also have a very strong connection to the Department of Corrections and to the MACPO counties, and we very often share our resources, and we're presently involved in a new cooperative effort on juvenile justice policy in this state. So what is CCA? The counties that we represent, and the commissioner alluded to this, the Community Corrections Act of 1973 allowed counties to provide community correction services in their county. And this generally means we do community supervision for both probation and supervised release. That's normally you hear of that as parole. We supervise adults and juveniles, and we supervise all level of crimes, from the petty misdemeanors all the way up to up and through the felonies. It is the complete package of services that we provide in our counties. There are 32 counties that participate in the Act, organized into 17 jurisdictions. And here's an important piece. At least I think it's an important piece. Of all the offenders you will find out on the street, 75% are supervised under our jurisdictions, under our combined jurisdiction. The state significantly funds our services through the Community Corrections Act. Now, why did our counties go this route, the CCA route? Well, it's very simple. It's about local accountability and it's about local control. Of extreme importance to our citizens is the fact that they know that they have a community corrections department that's accountable to them. They want to know, and they come to us frequently when we go out into the community, who lives there, what about those level three sex offenders, and what are you doing? The county board wants to know what services we need to provide and works with us to see that we're able to do that to the extent that is possible. And that is why community supervision tends to be so important, because we are so connected to our communities. What are the strengths of our overall correctional systems in this state? Well, community supervision is a cost-effective means of protecting public safety. You've heard the commissioner say that Minnesota incarcerates at a lower rate than all but one other state. And what we like to use as an example of some of this is if you look at our neighboring state to the east, Wisconsin. Wisconsin has a similar population to that of Minnesota. However, their system is the absolute opposite of ours. They incarcerate two and a half times the number of people that we incarcerate. And they overall spend 2.5 times what we spend. And now we've made a presentation before the House last week, and the issue of money, as you might expect, came up with these two competing systems. And this is, we did some very rough, down and dirty calculations. Basically, if you were to total the amount of dollars that is spent by the Department of Corrections that the CCA county spend and the MACPO county spend, it would come up to somewhere in the range, don't take this one to the bank, it's a rough estimate, $732 million, all right? Wisconsin, so the cost of corrections in Wisconsin is about $1.22 billion, all right? And they have no better outcomes than we have. So for your correctional dollar, I would say, you know, of course I have a vested interest in this, but for your correctional dollar, you're getting quite a bargain. It really saves you, the way we do business really saves you hundreds of millions of dollars, we believe. Our work, what is it that we do? Our job, very straightforward, very simple. Our job is to help stop the next crime. And it's to make one less victim in our community. And how do we do it? And you heard the commissioner allude to some of this. And we are moving at different paces in this state as to where we are with it. We assess the likelihood that an offender will reoffend or commit a new crime, and we supervise them according to that risk. We then look at what are the particular, we do this all with the assessment instruments the commissioner alluded to. We then do that. We look at what are the risk factors that an individual may have which, if left unaddressed and unattended, is likely. The research of over 40 years has suggested will lead to ongoing recidivism. It then becomes our job, through the probation officer and through community partners, to provide the services that will help address those risk factors. Likewise, some of the things that we have to do that really doesn't really necessarily speak to risk, but speaks to stabilization and being able to work with people, we have to help stabilize some of these cases. We can't very well supervise people who live under bridges. And so housing becomes an element. It also becomes a public safety element to the extent that we need to know where people are and where to find them. And the last thing that we do, broadly speaking, is that we enforce any condition of probation imposed by a court in this state, or any condition imposed by the Department of Corrections for supervised release. The challenges, again, the research of the last 40 years has done much to inform our practice in this state. It calls for a much better trained, highly skilled professional practitioner, which means lots of training and lots of practice and lots of quality assurance measures have got to be put in place. It also means that we are dealing, after all, with human beings and trying to do something about changing behavior so that people don't recidivate. So that means that you have to have the time to spend with people to do that. And part of our challenge is always to be able to provide the training, particularly in Greater Minnesota, which doesn't have the same kind of access that the metro area has, and to confront things like the windshield time that takes officers in Greater Minnesota to travel from one place to another. It all impacts our ability to do supervision. The other challenge that we have is our community partners. As our knowledge becomes more sophisticated, our community partners need to become more sophisticated and skillful. And that sometimes is a real challenge. As well as in Greater Minnesota, some of those services that are needed to reduce risk simply don't exist, and that is a real challenge for them. That concludes my part of the presentation about Community Correction Act counties. And so if you have any questions, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Ms. Roberts? Ms. Roberts, I do have a question.
Okay.
The question I have is in the reference under our work page, you talked about stabilizing offenders and making reference to housing. We've been dealing with people involved in the Second Chance organization. They come to us with the same concerns of how do they stabilize their lives in order to seek out a rehabilitated life. And is housing the only thing or maybe the principal thing to stabilize one's an address of where one can come and go from? Or does it expand more than that?
Oh, I'd say that housing is probably the factor that you will hear officers speak about most often. I think that other issues like getting people back on Medicaid so that they can access some of the services, that are directly related to ongoing criminality, that becomes an important thing. It also becomes an important thing if someone is so sick that they can't make it out in the community. So that also becomes an important factor. We have to figure out transportation for people, how they get from one place to another, and that can also be a very big challenge. If you think of the issues of daily living for all of us, you know, taking care of kids, having access to daycare, knowing how to get a Social Security card. Lots of people come out, they don't even have any kind of ID whatsoever. You can't. Just like we couldn't succeed in this society, in that state, neither can they. And to be able to get off the ground with them, to do the work that we're there to do, which is about public safety, some of these things really need to be attended to. But in terms, if you were to ask an officer, I think, and you'll be hearing from one, I don't know how it is in Greater Minnesota, but I know here the housing is a very big piece of business.
Thank you.
You're very
Any other
welcome.
Questions? Sarah Harrington.
Carol, how are you?
Senator.
Long time no see. I just wanted a quick question about technology and the use of technology in community corrections. That was the question I was going to ask Mr. Roy prior, but I'll ask him that next week. But I'm wondering about GPS, other tracking devices, things along that lines. Is that currently being used, and how effective is that?
Ms. Roberts.
GPS is currently being used, depending upon what kind of GPS you are using, active or passive. There are mixed results. There have been mixed results with that. I can tell you in Ramsey County, our new county attorney is talking about using GPS kind of a system for domestic violence. and I guess speaking to the legislature about the ability to help victims by giving them access to that technology. There are systems in place that help us have low-risk offenders report to us via technology. For instance, in Ramsey County, we have a telephone reporting system for people that are basically in compliance, where they can call in and leave their information or speak to a probation officer if that needs to be the case. So we're constantly, I think, as a system, we are constantly exploring new things.
Okay. One quick follow-up question, because I love the kind of the mission here of that we're working to support victims. I'm just wondering about how our corrections programs working in coordination with victims programs such as the county attorney's programs and state crime victims.
I can speak directly to the kinds of assistance that we give to victims. As you very well are aware, Senator, having been the lead agency in this effort, we have the St. Paul Intervention Project for domestic abuse, where the whole system of service providers and advocates for abuse victims are working with the entire system, including obviously the police and certainly corrections, in safeguarding victims. For sex offenders, departments work closely with their human services department to make sure that if there are children in the house, whether there should be children in the house, or making that assessment and making sure that children are kept safe. So there is a very substantial effort, and it's really crime-based. For the most part, where the work is most impressive and significant to helping victims. Did I answer your question, sir?
Yes, you did. Thank you very much.
Any other questions for Ms. Roberts? Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Limmer.
Steve Paquet. Yeah, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
It's Paquet.
Paquet. Welcome to the committee.
Brought with me. Steve Peterson, who's a court service director out of Waseca County. He's the president of MACPOL, Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. And I think Steve will make a few quick comments, and then I'll do my testimony.
Could you identify yourself for the record and the association you are speaking on behalf of?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Steve Peterson. I'm the current president of the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers, or MACPOL is how you'll hear the acronym frequently. My day job, I am the director of court services in Waseca County. So I appreciate the opportunity to make a few comments. Commissioner Roy went into a little bit of history. I'm going to go even a little bit further back, that in 1959, this is kind of surprising to me, but that Minnesota Department of Corrections was formed. That same year, the County Probation Act was also enacted, and it required that counties provide services to juvenile courts in one of three ways. Please bear with me on going through this. One was establish their own probation service, contract with the Department of Corrections, or have joint powers agreements with adjoining counties. In 1961, the first Probation Subsidy Act was enacted to provide a subsidy to counties for probation services. In 1969, the Community Corrections Act was passed, but not until 1973 was there subsidy that was attached to it. The reason that I bring the history up at all is that our current authorizing statutory authority, which is that Minnesota Statute 244.19, has some amazing similarities to what it was back in 1959. And in fact, it provides that the way services can be provided in counties, the same way as in 1959, the court, with the approval of the county boards, may appoint one or more salaried county probation officers. Two or more counties can go together. Or the third option is that the county can ask the Department of Corrections to provide services in that county. So in my mind, this is a long history of local counties providing services directly to their court with consultation and cooperation with the county board and with the Department of Corrections. So maybe it's a factor that I'm getting older, but it seems like there's wisdom in the fact that for many, many years, there's been the delivery system that counties have chosen to continue to participate in, meaning county probation officer or CPO counties. The statute also dictates the level of services. It's to satisfy the needs of the court. Again, that's done in consultation with all the players in the criminal justice system, including the Department of Corrections. The statute also talks about the duties, and very similar to what Ms. Roberts was talking about, we provide the court with services such as pre-sentence investigations for adults and juveniles, and I might add our jurisdiction includes juvenile offenders, adult misdemeanants, and adult gross misdemeanants, and in some counties we're providing pretrial services for all levels of offenders. The statute also provides that the counties are to receive from monies appropriated by the legislature up to 50% of the cost of salaries and expenses related to the probation services. So once again, that's my quick history lesson because it does seem to relate that in 1959 the legislature felt that there was a need for this sort of service, and there continues to be that same need, at least in the 27 counties that are still participating in it. I agree with both the commissioner and Ms. Roberts as far as the services that we're providing. I'd like to say that probation is probation, whether it's Ramsey County, Waseca County, or wherever it might be. All the probation officers are interested in public safety and the means that, by which we achieve that goal. We're all interested in making the community whole in the way of restorative justice practices and taking care of the victims. And we're all interested in providing our services through evidence-based practices so that we know that it's empirically researched that what we're doing makes sense. But I also bring to light the fact that probation officers were all from similar sorts of education. We attend similar colleges. As has been pointed out, we attend similar trainings. There's many things that we have in common with one another, not the least of which is we're doing a number of collaborative different efforts at this point in time. One of the most significant ones in my mind is that we all share the same database, the court services tracking system, so that we can communicate amongst ourselves as independent entities. Mr. Packley is with me, and I'm going to cut my stuff short, and so he has an opportunity to say a few words.
Mr. Packley, could you identify yourself for the record and the organization you represent?
Certainly. Steve Packley, P-A-Q-U-A-Y. I'm a court service director out of Chisago County, Minnesota, and I'm here today representing MACPOL, Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers.
Great. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks for the invitation. Tom and Carol have done a nice job giving an overall view of the correction system and some of the history, so I think I'll try to restrict my comments to some other areas that haven't been touched on. As you saw in one of the earlier PowerPoints, the county probation officer service delivery model is active in 27 counties in the state. We supervise all juvenile delinquency cases and all adult misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor cases, Typically, when we're working with the adults, we focus on adult domestic assault cases and DWI and repeat DWI cases. CPO departments range in size from anywhere from 2 probation officers to 27 plus support staff. So there's a broad range, and they're sprinkled all throughout Minnesota. Except for 2 key areas, we're basically viewed as county employees. The first is that probation officer positions are appointed by the local judiciary with the approval of the local county board to serve at the pleasure of the court. And again, that's in Minnesota Statute 244.19 is one of the 3 ways to provide services. The other area is that our probation officer salaries must be comparable to the state's salary ranges in order to qualify for partial state reimbursement for probation officer salary and fringe. So this is sort of a way from back in the earlier days when there weren't enough Department of Corrections probation officers around, they would tap into the existing county probation officers to provide typically juvenile probation parole work. So historically, we've provided juvenile probation and parole work for the kids who went down to Red Wing or other juvenile facilities. So one of the key issues that came up in the presentation for the Department of Corrections budget is that line item, CPO reimbursement. That's the money that comes through the Department of Corrections. That's pass-through money that goes to the 28 Department of Corrections contract counties and the 27 CPO counties for funding. And that offsets the cost that's already incurred by the local counties. So, for example, we'll be getting a reimbursement check for our salaries from 2010 sometime in, say, May of this year. So the 50% reimbursement hasn't occurred for a long time. Basically, we're about, in the last 5 years, this system has been underfunded by about $8 million. So those are costs that are passed on to the local counties to absorb. As far as the county side, the county board sets our department budgets and approves grant applications. Whenever I write a grant for federal money or anything, the county is the financial agency. We use county equipment, county office space, follow county policies for email, vehicles, the computers. We follow county benefit policies for vacation, sick time, mileage, insurance. My probation officers took no salary increase in 2010 and participated in a county 5-day unpaid furlough. So you can see that we're connected with how the counties operate. And we work closely with other members of the local criminal justice system, such as judges, county attorney, public defenders, local law enforcement, and Department of Corrections to implement programs and practices which address the local needs. So the focus is always on the local areas. We're members of local counties' criminal justice committees. We attend county out-of-home placement committees, domestic abuse work groups. We sit on local school advisory teams, underage drinking task forces, and many others. Our focus, again, is addressing criminal justice needs of the local community. The directors of the CPO counties meet once a month, usually, to review policies, new programs, and discuss topics of common interest. We strive to remain current with the new trends and research-based practices in our field. Many of the county probation officer counties have implemented evidence-based practices in our counties. We make use of risk assessments, which were spoken of earlier, to determine supervision levels. We use case planning, motivational interviewing when we're dealing with our probation officers. We make use of cognitive skills programs for both juveniles and adults. We've also implemented pretrial release supervision programs, drug testing procedures, diversion programs, community service work crews, and the DWI repeat DWI intensive supervision programs. We strongly believe that the county probation officer delivery model is efficient, effective, and responsive to the needs of the local benches and of the community.
Any questions? Mr. Paquet, the governor has recommended a 2.5% cut in a number of these budgets. How would that 2.5% cut affect your work or your agencies?
Mr. Chair, last year we received 33% salary reimbursement, and this year we're expecting somewhere around 20 or 31. So if it's 2%, we'll be down in the 29. So as the person who sets the budget for the department, that's a reduction in revenue, and the county is going to be looking at me to replace that. for the last several years, we've used things such as supervision fees for probation. And frankly, that's one of those fixes that works for a while. But if probationers can't pay their fees because they're not working and it goes to revenue recapture, and if they aren't paying income tax, you know, the revenue recapture is not going to work. So this is a key thing. We're trying to, basically, in most probation departments, at least for the CPO ones, it's typically a director, maybe a supervisor, 5-6 probation officers, maybe a secretary. That's about it. So, you know, we've already done things like cutting out training. We're reducing mileage, which is counterproductive because if the probation officers aren't in the community, what's really the point? We've implemented group supervision so we can bring typically 60, 70 adult offenders to our offices on first Tuesday night. So we can see a group of them that way. I have three probation officers staying late that night to cover that. But those are the kinds of fixes that are tough. So, you know, I really don't know what to say. We're going to be looking at reductions of probation officers because that's really all we've got. We're something like 90-some percent personnel.
So. What's your caseload?
Caseloads vary. On this morning, we had 1,500 cases in Chisago County. But that doesn't mean that much. Basically, some types of, as we heard earlier, we have different supervision levels based on risk. So some probation officers have 300 people. Some people have 15 and 20. So the way it's done in my county is we assess according to risk, and then we do a weighted caseload. The more hardcore cases that involve more work, you get more points, so your numbers then would be lower, so that it's a way of spreading it out. So juvenile cases have dropped in the last few years, so I moved one of my juvenile probation officers and pulled him over to the adult side. Those are the ways we have to try and balance things. But there is the point where we provide probation services, and it's basically bodies, and that's pretty much it.
Well, thank you. I should have asked that question to Ms. Roberts while she was here.
They're in the same boat, I can assure you.
All right. And I know the commissioner will be coming back on Thursday, so we can ask him a little more detail. Ms. Roberts, could you?
Yes, I can.
The governor with the 2.5% cut, how's that going to affect you?
Yes, I can. It's funny that you should ask. I just happened to be doing some figures as I was sitting back there. Looking at our largest county, which would be Hennepin, I suspect, again, can't take it to the bank, ballpark, a cut of $382,000. And our smallest county, which would be Rock Nobles, I believe, would be about $11,700. And I think you're going to see a similar theme to all of our answers. You know, there aren't too many choices out there. We are heavily dependent on personnel. Our agencies are mostly personnel, 85-90%. And so you're either looking to raise workload, and I think that we've done quite a bit of that in the last 8 years, or you're looking at a direct reduction of personnel.
Any other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question maybe for the probation officers. What percentage of offenders are serious offenders that you deal with?
Mr.
You would consider serious.
Senator.
Go ahead.
Basically, what we do is, in my caseload, now again, we don't do the felony cases. And there's kind of a perception that, well, if you don't do the felony cases, you're not doing the serious ones. Our contention is, some of the domestic abuse folks are pretty darn dangerous. The repeat DWI people are definitely shown to be a problem. So what I've done is basically, as I said, split those caseloads out among probation officers so that they can handle a smaller number of those, but spread out because they basically involve more time. So a typical probation officer would have. I'm just going to pull up one of my DWI probation officers. Okay, one of my DWI probation officers has 214 cases right now. I didn't break it out as to how many are gross misdemeanor ones, but basically what we've done is we have slid over the less serious cases over to case aides. And so my guess is that more than half of these numbers would be people that we have case plans for, not case plans for, but are supervising at, say, a medium to a high level. We would have, let me rephrase that. This person has, I'm trying to remember last week's staff meeting, she has seven people on what we call high. So those are people with complete case plans that have to be seen every day. And then she would have probably about 20 or so of those people be seen at a group report kind of level. And then we would have some of those other ones seen as at once a month level. Is that giving you some sort of
sure.
sense
Thank
of
you.
How we're doing this?
Every day.
Any other questions for the committee? Hearing none, I want to thank all of our witnesses, or not witnesses, testifiers today. And thank you for coming here. I don't believe there's any other business before the committee.
So keep these here.
Do we keep staff? Do we keep the budget books here, or they're nodding yes?
Good.
So we'll keep them here. Since there's no other business before the committee is adjourned.